Hi, everybody. I'm Kevin O'Donoghue, New York State licensed mental health counselor.
And I'm Nasima Diane Deemer, licensed massage therapist and trauma specialist. And this is The Positive Mind,
where we bring you some ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And today we have a guest. You know, sometimes we like to feature someone on our show who has turned things around, who has had an interesting life going from trauma, difficulty, violence, acting out, to a life of service and really great and deep integrity. And Richard D. Smith is a person who has accomplished just that. He's gone from childhood imprisonment to a national motivational speaker, and he likes to say giving a voice to the voiceless. He has a degree in Africana Studies from SUNY Albany. He's a social activist, the national director of Healing Works at Common Justice. He's a college professor at LIU in New York, in Brooklyn, and he's a workshop presenter, and we're going to talk a lot about his workshops with such topics as Black Men Grieve, Collective Liberation, Collective Healing, A Strengths-Based Approach to Healing, Men and Sexual Trauma, and many, many others. He's been presenting workshops and traveling as a speaker since 2006 at the ripe age of 26, and he'll be talking about the experience of trauma on a personal level and the experience of it on a societal and specifically African-American level on our show today, along with steps and modalities to heal. It's with great pleasure I invite and welcome Richard D. Smith to our studio. Hi.
Hi. How's it going?
Very well. So thank you for coming. Listen, you know, your CV is just so, so impressive, especially the variety of your workshop presentations, and we're going to get to that. But you know, we were talking before the show about trauma and transformation, and I know I use that word because I like to think that some of my mission and work with people is to transform, to help them change. But you made a very, I thought, useful point and something that's sticking with me and that I really need to use to approach, as to not so much transformation as to understanding. Understanding first what happened, and then what do we do going forward? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, excellent. I think part of the reason why the trauma-informed approach was so significant, it definitely for me, because one of the things that it contributed to the field of mental health, and specifically the research and the work that we were doing around trauma, was this major shift from what's wrong with you to what happened to you. And so we were training ourselves to shift our perspective to understanding that there were previous experiences that were ultimately traumatic that contributed to the behaviors that people were exhibiting. And so ultimately, their behaviors were symptomatic of PTSD or traumatization. And so when you think about someone like myself who had experiences of traumatization, specifically childhood sexual abuse, other forms of abuse, as well as community violence, and a lot of the behaviors that I exhibited that people could not understand. And quite frankly, I did not have the capacity to articulate what was happening to me. Those behaviors were labeled as maladaptive or deviant and ultimately as criminal, but essentially they were rooted in my trauma responses and the ways in which I learned how to adapt to my environment, utilizing those trauma responses to the best of my ability. And so the whole transformation process is almost like a reconnecting, right? Or like reprocessing, right? Of those experiences in a way that can relieve you of the previous adaptive strategies that you learned in order to cope. And so that's kind of like the way that I describe my transformation process, which unfortunately took place inside of a prison cell and multiple prisons for the duration of a decade. And it was during this time that I encountered some of the most compassionate, and I know it's hard to believe for some of the listeners, that these were some of the most compassionate men that I've ever met in my life. And they also had the credibility of sharing similar past experiences in which allowed them to see beyond my rough exterior and see my trauma responses for just that. Funny enough, none of us were calling it trauma back then. It wasn't until years later when I got out of prison and I started to do work with young people myself, and I was able to get some training from this gentleman by the name of Dr. Macy in Boston. I went through a psychological first aid training, and he used this term trauma. And I was like, oh, that's what it was, right? And then when he started to talk about the neuroscience and the neurological response to trauma and the way that it impacts our bodies and our behaviors unconsciously, you know, right, it was just like a aha moment that helped me understand. And to this day, I believe that for the most part, all of the behaviors that we observe that are oftentimes inexplicable are rooted in trauma responses.
Would it be possible for you to like get specific about a couple of behaviors, like ones that you typically see, and like what that's, how that's a coping strategy?
Yeah, yeah. So I can talk about, for me, specifically as it relates to childhood sexual abuse. And this was something that definitely came to me in prison while facilitating a group with other men who were incarcerated. And we started talking, and, you know, all of a sudden the conversation started to move towards like childhood sexual abuse, driven by one of the guys inside's experience where their daughter was being sexually abused. And so that opened up a conversation with, you know, about 40 of us men talking about the traumas that we experienced. And then one of the gentlemen started talking about their sexual abuse that they had never disclosed. And this gentleman here was a really, he was known to be like a tough guy, right? He was known to be very aggressive and violent. And then when he started talking, it triggered me in a way that I started to remember how I felt. And one of the things that he said is that the only time that he felt normal is when he was being angry. And that led me to look into like the ways in which men who have survived childhood sexual abuse respond differently, and the ways that we just respond as a result of the socialization of masculinity and manhood, and what we're taught to believe is the way that we should protect ourselves, yeah, even as a child. And so the trauma responses in that case, and for my experiences, were a hyper aggressiveness, you know, this hyper sense of masculinity to compensate for fears of being considered effeminate or homosexual or less of a man, because those that experience kind of like clashed with those ideas about manhood and masculinity that I had internalized.
And it makes sense. I mean, anger is a great way to feel empowered.
Yes.
And you need it to protect yourself. So take it to the furthest end, the extreme. We can look at somebody who is angry all the time or severely angry or enraged as somebody who's hurting.
Yeah.
You know, and needing their rage and needing their anger to protect themselves. And potentially somebody who's been abused sexually or otherwise, that an extremely angry person, if we just step back and, you know, pause and think, what have they been through? What has happened to this person? Instead of reacting and trying to manage them and actually put them in a box, that anger can be really useful for survival purposes.
Yeah.
I'm curious about in prison, because we hear all these dark stories about prison, and your experience in prison was enlightening. How did that happen? I mean, was there a mixture of violence and terror and horror in prison along with these compassionate people who run these programs or created a program?
Yeah, I think, you know, so, you know, two things. One thing that I definitely want to clarify is that I really don't like to give credit to prison for, like, you know, precipitating that transformation.
Okay.
I give credit to the men who are on the inside.
Absolutely. I like that.
Because I don't think that you need to be in cage and treated as inhumanely as we often are in prison in order to start that process of healing. And then when you think about it from a trauma lens, you have all of these folks who've encountered a tremendous amount of trauma throughout their lives, and you put them in the same space. And we all have these same types of trauma responses that it's just, yes. You know, it does create a recipe for disaster and chaos and violence. But, you know, the point that I've always tried to make and that I will continue to make is that these are trauma responses. And the same way we talk about hurt people, hurting people, people who are on their healing journey can help other people's heal. And those men, the compassionate men that I referenced earlier, were the ones who had already started their healing journey. And they saw potential in me and they were able to help me heal. The other thing I wanted to add, too, is when you think about many of the spaces in which young people are in, right, institutions that we're in, whether it's the school system, even hospitals, the medical industry, like these spaces, these institutions have not been trained on trauma. So now more than ever, these institutions are incorporating like trauma-informed approaches and realizing that it's imperative for us to understand that when this young person, you know, in class acts out, that it's not associated with them just being oppositional defiant disorder or antisocial as an adult, but they are responding to that anger. That anger is a response to that pain. You used the term earlier, acting out. That acting out is stemming from something. I'm really happy that we decided to incorporate trauma-informed approaches to all of these institutions now so that we can take that into consideration before we start the process of labeling and stigmatizing people for just responding to pain and trauma.
Yeah, because you need a game plan when a person comes into prison. I want to ask you, do you recommend like an intake of childhood experiences for potential prisoners, let's say at whatever age, 15, 18, 20, because it's almost guaranteed that they have suffered what we call adverse childhood experiences, which are things like watching your mother get hit chronically or being hungry a lot of the time and no food in the house, or having a family member who is suicidal or someone suffering from severe mental illness. If you grow up around these things, you know, it's going to make sense that you're going to act out and be guarded and protect yourself and be reactive. And I think it sounds like it would be really useful for the prison system to take note of each individual, not just that they're labeled as a criminal and the crime they committed and how long their rap sheet is, but when did it start for them? That I guess I'm saying that the prison system asks, what happened to this person? Is there resources for that? Did you experience that? Do you recommend that? Do you see that as a potential positive development?
I know of some amazing folks who are doing work in prisons, volunteers who are coming into the prisons to try to be that beacon of hope and shed light on the impact of trauma and past experiences of ACEs, you know, adverse childhood experiences. But the prison system itself is not designed to do that. And so we got to totally deconstruct that system and recreate a system that is more humane and more considerate, because, you know, you're not going to be able to convince the administrators, the guards, the folks who have been trained to perpetuate this us versus them mentality for their survival. Right. Right. And then many of them are traumatized. I think a way to start would be to like help the guards and administrators understand the impact of trauma in their lives. That was something that I found really interesting about the Kaiser Permanente study, the ACEs study, and like that it was overwhelmingly white folks, middle class folks. And I remember reading it and like saying to myself, wow, if they had these high ACE scores, imagine what, you know, poor people in communities of color ACE score would look like, right? We could start there. And I think the same thing applies to officers, law enforcement in general, to have them understand the impact of trauma on their lives and how they can find themselves in situations that are very triggering. But I think we totally have to deconstruct this system of punishment and institute one that's more restorative, one that's more conducive to taking into consideration all of the previous experiences that have led to the behaviors that were trauma responses and stigmatized and ultimately criminalized. But we also have to factor in the elephant in the room and the reality that racism is real and racism exacerbates that, you know, that experience of trauma, right? And so, you know, one of the things that I was doing with my research for my doctoral work is interviewing school social workers to see what their experiences were like treating African-American male survivors or boys who had survived childhood sexual abuse, to see if there was a difference between the way that they perceived the behaviors of African-American boys as opposed to girls, but also to boys who were not African-American. And, you know, preliminarily, I've found, and tons of research has found, that there's a tremendous amount of discrimination that's rooted in racism that starts in our school system, right? The concept of the school-to-prison pipeline is rooted in that idea and that reality of there being discrimination based on race, based on gender, that's leading to the disproportionate suspension and expulsion rates of boys of color in our school districts. And then we know that, like, when you are suspended, you're expelled, and then you're not making up for your grades academically, and you find yourself out of school because you drop out of school. And the more time that you have on the outside, the more time you have to roam. In my case, I dropped out in the eighth grade after being left back twice and tracked into special education. And the more time I had on the street, the higher the probability of me engaging in behavior, combined it with the trauma responses that would lead to being arrested.
Right.
Yeah.
So we'll just make it clear. You were imprisoned at 16, age 16, you were born to a mother who was substance abuse, drug addict. Is that true?
Yeah, my mother also was a trauma survivor and had unaddressed trauma. And that's the thing, right? It's ubiquitous. One of the things we say, it's universal.
Right.
And you know, as a trauma expert, it's like everyone, the way that we, you know, and that's why I think it's so imperative for us to consider racism as a mitigating factor when you think about trauma being ubiquitous and universal. So we all experience trauma, but there's a different experience when you're a black boy or a black girl and you go to a school and you're exhibiting trauma responses and the white teacher perceives you in a way that views you consistent with racist ideas about your behavior, about the way that you act out, and then stigmatizes you, that leads to you being either supported, it could lead to even you being supported with services to try to get at the root of it, but it also can lead to you being stigmatized and suspended and expelled, which unfortunately is the case in too many instances for young black boys and black girls.
Nobody's going to own that they're a racist. Nobody would say, yes, I'm a racist. So often racism is an unconscious thing. People will project upon a race of people or a stereotype of any person, projected from their unconscious onto a whole field and group of people. You are a spokesperson for the Black Indigenous People of Color.
All right, BIPOC, yeah.
BIPOC. Mm-hmm. And I want you to educate people on this term indigenous, because I think it's important in this context, because often trauma goes back generations, many generations.
Right.
Your mother's mother was probably traumatized.
Right.
And most, you know, let's face it, I mean, I know that in doing research for my work, it's been said that over 90% of people have been traumatized somewhat in some degree.
Right.
So can you talk a bit about this word indigenous, if it is connected to trauma in general, and what you try to teach people about Black Indigenous People of Color?
Yeah, I think we should start as just the understanding of historical trauma, right? And we talked a couple days ago about the research that was done with the descendants of Holocaust survivors and the study of epigenetics and transgenerational trauma and the way transmission of trauma and the way that, you know, descendants who have not experienced trauma themselves, the direct experience of trauma of the Holocaust, these descendants showed the same sorts of symptoms and the way that it impacted their memory and their recollection of experiences that they did not directly experience themselves, and how that impacts the coding or of our DNA. And so we know that there's like this historical trauma that's real. We know that there's this intergenerational trauma. So there's this historical trauma that's rooted in these like unique experiences. And then that trauma is transferred from one generation to the next. It's done psychologically, it's done biologically and neurologically, right?
Right.
And so we know that, yeah, when you think about my mother's experience of trauma and you think about the fact that her grandmother was enslaved, and then you think about that history of enslavement that black people have experienced in this country, of the or the any historical oppression that groups have experienced, and how that traumatic experience, I mean, you cannot get a more inhumane, catastrophic, devastating experience than the transatlantic slave trade, in which millions of people were slaughtered and treated like cattle, and how that experience lived in the bodies and lives in our bodies to this day, and the way that it influences how we interact with each other, as well as how we interact with folks who are not from our community, who are not black.
And I'm sorry, but it takes patience to process this for yourself. You can become vulnerable. Like when you start investigating this, I could imagine, and trying to undo this and fully understand it, that at the same time you have to live in the world. And that this process in itself can be a vulnerable experience to understand these things. And then you go back out into the street to the same violence, the same street that's acting the way that it's acting. And you have to be prepared to meet that world as well. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To be open to these things.
I hear it. And then the other thing, well, one of the things I'll say about that is, I mean, let's face it, the experience of the transatlantic slave trade and chattel slavery was designed to just, you know, after black folks were no longer considered useful and needed for this system, for this economic system in this country, they didn't care. Folks didn't care whether they lived or died, right? And then some of it was rooted in really deep-seated anger and resentment, you know, towards black people. But a lot of it was rooted in economical advantages, and people were able to exploit people and even exploit those people who were angry, right? But that anger led to some really inhumane castration and, you know, hangings you know, burnings, like, right?
Right.
And so you have these experiences. At the same time, black people are able to survive this like attempt to almost like commit genocide and extinguish this group of people.
Right.
So the same way that there was intergenerational trauma, there was intergenerational healing. The same way that there was historical trauma, there's historical healing.
Right.
There were ways in which we healed ourselves simultaneously while still dealing with the constant, you know, consistent trauma, right? And people even talking about it now, instead of saying pulse, right? We're talking about complex trauma. We're talking about persistent trauma. And if you think about it, not only just historically to this day, when you hear young people who are experiencing situations of interpersonal violence in their community, they're experiencing police brutality, but they're also working to heal themselves simultaneously,
right?
While this is still going on.
Right.
I think it's amazing. I think it's nothing short of miraculous. But I also do think that there needs to be spaces that are created. There needs to be resources that are generated to be very intentional about this effort of helping folks, specifically folks of color, to address the experiences of historical trauma, the current experiences of trauma that we're having at the hands of state-sanctioned violence, police brutality, and so forth.
You know, it's in this context that our conversation a few days ago about this idea of transformation, that a young black African-American person could take in this idea and this understanding of, you know, trauma and abuse and, you know, just ritual taking advantage, and take that into himself and maybe identify with that as his cultural heritage.
Mm-hmm.
The odds, the work needed to get rid of that concept. And then inputting this idea of survival. We did survive. You know, it was attempted to really get rid of us totally. And yet we have a legacy of survival. That this concept of instead of transformation, but in what happened, is so empowering in that way. That it struck me, this is now we have a foundation to build on. We were ritually abused and imprisoned and just violated, and but we survived. And now, what do we put in to flourish? Because you talk about the first step is what happened, and then the next step is, well, what have you got?
Mm-hmm. And what's right with you,
what's
right?
What's right with you.
Yeah, right. So Dr. Sean Jenright talks about that in his healing-centered engagement concept, right? The shift is not what's, you know, goes from what happened to you to what's right with you. And we also hear that in post-traumatic growth, right? The distinction between post-traumatic growth and resilience, right? So resilience is getting back to baseline functionality. The threat is no longer present as much. You can be resilient. Or if it becomes too normalized in your environment, that you just learn how to be resilient and function in the midst of it. But then the next step is like, how do you grow? What's right with you? And I think we are seeing that, right? Because despite these experiences of trauma historically and currently, and violence, Black people, people of color are continuing to not only just be resilient, but to thrive and that to produce, right? To produce so many things. I mean, to become, you know, politicians, to become politicians that are trying to transform our criminal justice system, our criminal legal system, like Ayanna Pressley, or like people who are, you know, producing some amazing art in like, you know, so there's yes, all of these yes. instances in which, despite this history of trauma, not only are we resilient and just getting beyond that experience, but we're thriving. And that is why I do the work that I do, because I think it's possible for all of us. I think as long as we support each other with this on this healing journey, there's a possibility that you can get beyond just survival, beyond resilience, to growing and then making a major contribution to our society. Yeah.
I want to talk about vision when we come back from our break. We're about to take our break. You're listening to The Positive Mind. I'm Kevin O'Donohue, licensed mental health counselor, here with Richard D. Smith, motivational speaker, national speaker, a real advocate for the voiceless. And we're going to resume our discussion after this musical break. We'll be right back. And we are back. I'm Kevin O'Donohue, licensed New York State mental health counselor. We are here with Richard D. Smith, the National Director of Healing Works at Common Justice, assistant professor at LIU Brooklyn, and a social justice change agent. We've been talking about trauma, intergenerational trauma, systemic trauma. And we've been talking about the specifics of trauma, but also finding and asking what happened first, and then finding what's right with me, what's good with me. Richard, it strikes me as when you get to that point where you're starting to take an inventory of your personal strengths, your assets, the good stuff that you have, that the real way to accelerate growth is to have a vision for that individual person to say, okay, I have these good qualities now, different from my friends, my brothers, you know, other men in my cohort. Now, what do I do with it? Can you talk about A, personally, your experience with that, and B, whether you think that's a good thing, modality or idea in treatment and conversation with people who have been traumatized in general?
Yeah, great question. I think, you know, one of the things I try to do in training, specifically with folks who are direct service providers, advocates or clinicians and so forth, is to stress the importance of having both a systems analysis to complement their analysis or understanding of individual behavior, right? Because part of what you're talking about, in order for you to have a vision, there needs to be agency. There needs to be like this internalized system of control, a locus of control, where you believe that having this knowledge, starting this healing journey, but also I can start to have an impact on my environment. My environment is not going to prevent me from being able to make this vision come into fruition. And I think that's the piece that's oftentimes missing with clinicians, because they'll say, hey, you can do this. And, you know, this is a good starting point. You're starting to realize stuff happened to you. But if you don't have a racial analysis, if you don't have a power analysis to understand that there's still systems of oppression that are denying people access, that are still causing harm, despite this person being able to understand the impact of their experience of childhood sexual abuse or community violence, there's still these other systems of oppression that are continuing to traumatize them and deny them access to the resources and the power that they need to not only just come up with a vision, but feel like that vision can come into fruition at their own will.
I mean, I think it's one of the hallmarks of being a traumatized individual is that you don't have a sense of a future. It just doesn't exist. You're living hour to hour sometimes in that sort of hyper-vigilant, traumatized state. Like, vision? Who needs, you know, it's like, I'm just trying to survive here. And so, yeah, that what you're talking about is a little bit like what we discussed in the past about learned helplessness and learned optimism. There's a sort of significant learned helplessness around, I can't impact my environment. I can't, in fact, impact systemic racism. I mean, it's huge. And it makes sense that that would be like a core thing that needs to be, you know, addressed and seen and held.
Absolutely. And so even if you think about my situation, I can go through this journey of, you know, healing, starting on the inside, that led to, you know, me going to college on the inside, educating myself as much as I possibly could, and then coming out and then having this vision for myself that I developed on the inside, and then finding out that this job that I really wanted to get, I can't get it because I've been charged with a felony. And it's this like indelible scar that will never go away.
Right.
Even though I'm equally qualified, I still can't get an opportunity to interview for this position. And so then, you know, the systems analysis would say, okay, how is this fair and just, right? Given all of the racism that's rooted in the punishment paradigm that has become our criminal legal system, how can I change that? What can I do to try to change these policies or change these laws that prevents people who've served their time, who've paid their debt to society, even though, right, we're not even factoring in that, like, the crime or the behaviors were rooted in trauma responses. We're not even talking about that.
Right,
but just the current reality, I want to go out and get a job so I can provide for my family. I can't because I have a felony conviction, right? And so that's why the power analysis, the systems analysis is so important for this process. And then you think about learned helplessness and you think about learned optimism in a way that if you are able to connect with, and I think that's what we're seeing now with all of the uprisings in the streets, in the communities, people realizing that we have to do with people, with corporations, who a lot of corporations have benefited from our prison industrial complex,
sure,
benefited from people's unaddressed trauma and trauma responses, whether it manifests itself in how we eat, poor diet that, you know, the medical model benefits from, or whether, you know, investing money in, like, you know, school safety officers, these policies that demand for additional surveillance cameras in schools because these kids are responding to trauma, but on the surface, it looks like they're just acting out and misbehaving, and therefore there's a need for us to create some sort of, like, carceral condition in these schools that requires money. And so people are capitalizing off of the trauma responses. And so us as people, we have to figure out what we can do collectively to try to counter that, to introduce that understanding of this being trauma responses, that this trauma is persistent, that it's systemic, that it's oftentimes state sanctioned, and we are demanding changes be made so that people can have equal access to the opportunities and the resources that we need to heal, grow, and thrive.
You know, when you were talking before, I was just thinking about discouragement. You know, with these systemic things in place, it's one thing to have a vision and then, you know, get an action plan. And then you run up against these systemic conditions and situations that are going to be setbacks. You were talking about resilience also. How does somebody bounce back from these setbacks, the systemic issue, once they've had the vision and started going in that direction? It has to be more than just simply understanding, okay, this is me running up against this thing again, and I have to find out another strategy on how to do it. Do they need a community in order to reinforce the vision so that they can have a common language to move forward?
Yeah.
What's recommended? What do you do with somebody who's like, okay, I got the vision. I know the good stuff that I have. I'm taking the steps to get there. Even in your case, what did you do? You realized I was a felon. I couldn't get that job. What do you do to bounce back? Do you re-envision? Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's so interesting you're bringing this up, because, like, in the past, it's often been, as Black people, we said we have to work twice as hard as our white counterparts, right?
Right.
We have to be very strategic on an individual level in order to survive in a system that is racist and that denies us access to equal opportunities or equitable opportunities and resources. And so on an individual level, that's been the narrative. And then earlier you said, you know, no one's going to admit that they're racist. People are always going to say, I'm not a racist, and it's a subconscious process. But this is why I like Dr. Ibram X. Kendi's work about how to be an anti-racist, because he says there's either you're a racist or you're an anti-racist. I'm not a racist is not good enough, because when we think about it collectively and when we think about it from a position or a perspective of power, what he says, and I agree wholeheartedly, if you are not working to dismantle systems that are racist, if you're at a school and you see that there's a disproportionate suspension and expulsion rate of Black boys, and you are not speaking out against it, you are not trying to go to the Board of Education or figure out a way to change that, to make it just and equitable and to remove that racist policy, then you're racist. And so there's only room for races and anti-races. And I think that was something that really took people by storm and confused folks, because, you know, for a while, especially after, you know, Trump administration got into office, everyone was saying, I'm not a racist. You know, that was the thing. I'm not a racist.
Right. Right.
Right. But that's not sufficient.
Right.
And then the other thing I always tell people who, especially direct service folks who do this work from a really good place, they have a heart to help, to serve, and they truly are invested in that process. But I also say that it's going to take a tremendous amount of courage. It's going to take a tremendous amount of courage that may cause you to compromise some of the privileges that you benefit from as a result of your whiteness, as a result of your education and your socioeconomic status.
Right.
And so when we talk about allies, people saying, what type of ally, you know, are you an ally? Are you a white ally? I actually take it a step further. because allyship to me is just saying, hey, I support Black Lives Matter. To me, I think you need to be an accomplice. You have to be willing to be an accomplice and put some skin in the game and say, I'm willing to risk something, right? To make sure that these policies that are inequitable, that are rooted in racism, get changed.
Right.
And so I think to your question, like there has been this historical individual strategy that you have to work twice as hard. But now we're realizing that we have to do this collectively by changing these policies that perpetuate it, right? That story of the woman who was picking the baby out of the river. And then every day there was a baby in the river. And then finally she had to go up to the top of the river and say, who the heck was throwing these babies in the river?
That's right.
Right? And so we have to stop it systemically, whatever's perpetuating it.
I have to say I'm having a reaction. I think people who might be racist who don't know it, they need a transition period. They need an education period. They can't just jump immediately to the anti-racist platform. But just like what we were saying before about transformation, what happened? Why was I a racist and I didn't even know it? And, you know, how am I exhibiting and showing that in my life? And there has to be like a process, I think, just like there's a process going from, you know, a traumatized individual to an empowered individual. And that a person needs to unlearn their racism before they can just jump to the anti-racist form. I mean, I'm an anti-racist. I mean, I definitely am, but I'm not involved. I'm doing the Positive Mind radio show. And now you're adding another dimension to the work that I want to do. But I think, you know, especially in this complicated country, people need a way to make the transition. First, it has to start with identification. I do see that now. And I do see how I perpetuate it. I want to be an ally. What steps do I need to take? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Because I do want to get back to some talk about trauma, but you can speak to what I'm talking about. I think this vast amounts of communities need to get educated and realize, and maybe that perspective, how am I – okay, I say I'm an anti-racist. I say I'm not racist. How am I in my daily life perpetuating the fact that maybe I am?
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the things that taught me that, and I think it's a muscle, it's like a muscle that you have to develop.
Okay.
Is just seeing the struggle that women, especially women of color, go through. And then people of color who are part of the LGBTQIA community.
Right.
As a cis heterosexual man, like I am, you know, whether I'm conscious of it or not, in some ways, complicit, right? And so I have to make efforts to create space to amplify the voices of, right? And some of those voices may come at me, right, as being an extension of those same, you know, systems of oppression that are rooted in patriarchy that has led to harm. And I have to be able to hold that in a way where I don't take it personally.
Right.
Where I realize that it's not about me and it's not going to be easy. So it really has to be this muscle that we develop, this emotional muscle, this stamina to hold that while simultaneously realizing that we have to play a role. We can't just sit by and be complacent because we become complicit, and we have to be intentional about our efforts to support their movement, to amplify the voices of other groups who are oppressed. And I think that's where this whole notion of intersectionality comes into play, realizing that there are different levels, experiences of oppression that plays out based on various elements of your identity, right? If you're a formerly incarcerated queer woman of color, the levels of oppression that you experience, not only in a system of white supremacy or racism, but what you experience as a result of patriarchy and like interpersonal trauma that you experience and oppression among your own people who are cis or heterosexual, right? And believe in heteronormativity. Like all of these different elements of your identity contributes to, you know, various levels and layers of oppression. But I'm also one that says that we can't play oppression Olympics, but realize that we're all going against these systems, and we need to see the ways in which they intersect. We need to see the ways in which they interlock, and that we need to not just be intersectional with our description and understanding, but we need to show some solidarity and show up for each other.
Right.
So if there's a, you know, Black trans march or a protest that's happening, you know, folks who are not from that community need to show up. You know, if there's a march or like, you know, a campaign to close a prison by formerly incarcerated people, even if you're not formerly incarcerated, you need to show up. Because the fact is, as long as oppression is happening for one group, it's going to be happening for every group.
Right. Right. And I think even as a white, you know, Caucasian American, I mean, the legacy of slavery in this country and the ritual systemic abuse of African Americans up to the present day is something that I have to deal with. And that's part of my legacy, my inheritance. And I have to name the violations and the abuse and how that, you know, is infected any community that I'm involved with. So what I love about this is that, you know, America's a place that's not a simple place. You know, we're not, you know, America's, there's a complication of character that can go with being American and living in this land that other countries don't have because of they don't have the diversity and they don't have the necessary legacy of oppression that America has instituted. And that for current living Americans, white or Black or Chinese or any form, that this inheritance of oppression is a byproduct, you know, is a product of living in this country, and you need to understand it. And it's nice to understand that as we're talking on an individual level and the traumas that individuals experience, but it's also good to understand it in a general sense as a condition of being a citizen in
this
country.
And it's a byproduct of capitalism, right?
Correct. Absolutely.
Right? And
absolutely.
The rugged individualism that capitalism promotes.
Right.
Right. And the fierce competition that it promotes.
Right.
Right. And so inequality is a direct result of people wanting to access or not let go of their access to the resources that gives them the privileges, that gives them the advantages, that if you ask an individual, I have to take care of my family, right?
Right.
So it's hard to get people to say that they want to relinquish control and power for right. the sake of creating equity in a system of capitalism that rewards individualism.
Right.
And your ability to compete, right. survive, yeah. and surmount
right.
Other folks in this race.
Yes. It is a race, isn't it? Another type of race, but it is a race.
It's like if we just slow down and feel and hear people's experiences, start to, and not, you know, we rush to judgment. We rush in so fast. And it's like if you could slow down schools and teaching a little bit, you know, if you could slow down the medical system a little bit, you might actually hear, like, everybody's so pressured for time. And that's a result of capitalism, too. Like, you got to move, move, move. Time is money.
Right.
Well, time is, you know, that is trauma. You know, that's very traumatizing because you're like, I have to move fast. I have to do this fast. And it's like, I think we've kind of learned, like we can stop. We stopped a huge economy. Yeah. What's happened in that stop? We've talked about that a lot. But, like, if you just sort of stop and slow down, you might feel something. And in that feeling, you're vulnerable and you can connect.
Well, my immediate reaction is that we've slowed down and then we've gotten angry.
Anger's there.
Now I see what's going on, and I'm angry. I'm angry about, you know, what's happened to African Americans in this mm-hmm. country. I'm angry about the control of corporations on my life. I'm angry about, you know, the way my kids are being educated. I'm angry, you know, so I think that's often what comes out when people slow down, unfortunately. So I agree with you in the terms of trauma. The initial step in trauma is to get the person angry, right? I mean, if you're angry already, I mean, I'm generalizing, but you don't want to get them necessarily. But I mean, I think a good, useful step for somebody who, let's say, is helpless or learned helplessness or depressed is, yes, to get their fire back. Let's get you energized. Let's get some and continue to tell me your story. Continue to tell me what happened. And the change, the development will happen once that outlet has opened up. But I agree that, you know, we want to get people feeling first. Richard, we only have a few minutes left. I did want you to talk a little bit about your journey and what you're doing in the world now. Can you say close us out with I mean, your CV, you have like 5 pages of workshops. I mean, we haven't even touched upon in this show, and we're definitely having you back about black men grieve, sexual abuse. You know, I mean, I could read out to the audience. I will do that the next show. All of these workshops that Richard is leading and a part of, the school to prison pipeline, I'm very curious about that. So can you talk a little bit more about your story, what you're doing out there in the world now, and please come back?
Yeah, definitely come back. And, I really wanted to touch on what you're saying, because I think
it's so
important for us to think about, because you're right, the rat race keeps us moving in a way that we aren't able to sit and listen to each other and hear these stories. Because I think that's the power. The power comes through the stories when you can sense and feel the pain of people that you might not have been aware of. You see a person every day. The person that we walk past who's working on the bathroom, right? And then we're meaning-making machines. This person might give you a look, but you're rushing to get in here to get set up for this radio, for this podcast, right? You don't have time to say, hey, what's happened to you, right? Mm. We make meaning of the situation, and you're right. It's an instinctual, kind of like a protective process that happens, that we make meaning that oftentimes leads to prejudices and, like, judgment that is inaccurate. It's always inaccurate, right? Because we don't have always the information. And I think that's a big part of what I do in the world, is like create spaces for people to share their narratives and their stories, to understand what happened to people, and then understand like what's right with people and what we can do to support those people who are on a journey for helping others. And that's where Healing Wounded Healers and that work came from for me, because I realized that there were folks who were out here really, really engaged and committed nonstop supporting folks who've been experiencing trauma as a result of community violence and various forms of violence. But they weren't having their healing needs met. They were just doing. And I realized that the people who do the service work, and that's why I push back on self-care, the people who do the service work struggled the most for caring for themselves. The people who cared for others struggled the most for caring for themselves. You know, you see that people are good at making sure everyone is okay, but not themselves. And so I said, we can't say self-care anymore. We need to create spaces for community care where we can support each other in a real way, so that the folks who are doing this work, who are so important and so valuable to this work around healing, can get their healing needs met, so it can be done in a sustainable way. And so I've been doing a lot of work around that, helping those who are doing the work, and then work around shifting the narrative in a way that people can understand that there are more than one way of understanding and knowing the experiences of people. And so, yeah, I would love to come back.
We're definitely going to do this, Richard. I just want to say, on a personal level, I mean, I can see how you're a person who can create space for people. You have a very soothing voice. Your answers are very thoughtful, very wide-ranging, your answers, and thorough. So I could see how you could create space for people where healing could occur. You've been listening to The Positive Mind. I am here with my guest, Richard D. Smith. How can people get in touch with you?
You can reach me at, you can have my email, richardsmithspeaks@gmail.com. My website will be up soon. That's also richardsmithspeaks.com. But my IG handle is rsspeaks. Twitter, rsspeaks. I'm not as active on Twitter, but I'm planning to become more active. I'm a little busy being a dad and doing all that stuff, but I would love to be more. Actually, if you want to help me with Twitter and like getting some of these views out, send me a tweet or a message, a DM, whatever they say nowadays.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. Well, thank you so much for being with us. You've been listening to The Positive Mind. We want to thank some of our affiliates airing The Positive Mind: KXCR 90.7 in Florence, Oregon, KYGT 102.7 Idaho Springs, KPPQ in Ventura on 104.1.
and WGRN 94.1 in Columbus, Ohio, WRWK 93.9 in Richmond, Virginia. We'd also like to thank our producer, Connie Shannon, and our chief engineer, Jeff Brady. And you can contact us at tffpp.org with questions, comments, or suggestions for the show. So that's actually info@tffpp.org.
That's the Foundation for Positive Psychology. Or you can call, email me, Kevin@thepositivemind.com.